Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. We are recording this episode in mid-March for a late April release, but I'm getting ahead on the show so that I can take a break. I'm going to take a month off and it's going to be delightful. I'm so happy to be welcoming my dear friend Seth Martell back to the show, as well as the incredible historian and author David Morrow. David wrote an incredible book called Classic X-Men 1975, which happens to be what my show is spending like this whole year on, so it's been really fun to interface. David also runs the incredible Classic X-Men account on Instagram. You probably follow it. There's incredible content coming out all the time. We're going to be talking about Nightcrawler in the latter half of today's episode. We get to delve into a lot of origin stories as we're going through this year, and this one is really fucking depressing. I reread it in preparation for this episode and made my notes, and I'm like, oh no, this is the worst part of Nightcrawler, but it's also really beautifully drawn, and we have a lot to talk about today. Let me welcome both of you to the show. I'll have you use your name and pronouns. Let me know a little about yourselves and where people might know you from. And our intro question for today is, I mean, what's your single favorite quality about Nightcrawler? Let's begin with the wonderful David Morrow. David, welcome to Grey Malkin Lane.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me here. And you can call me David or David as you wish.
They're probably both going to come out of my mouth interchangeably. Yeah. So I'm glad you're okay with that.
Well, my pronouns are his. As you have said, I'm the person behind Classic X-Men Instagram account, which is delving very much on X-Men history behind the scenes. I would say that's the main focus on Instagram. And well, I'm from Spain. I think you can see that from my accent. And I've been a fan, a long life fan for the X-Men, and that's the main thing that drove me and drives me every day to, you know, post and blog about the classic period of the X-Men, and specifically the Claremont run is my expertise, let's say, my domain. And yeah, about Nightcrawler, I think that the quality that I most value is his humanity. It is contradictory to his appearance, but I think that's a defining thing within the team, right?
Yes, absolutely. I'm so excited to pick your brain about where you come from and what makes you put all this content out. I think we are very similar, the three of us. We love what we love, and we channel it into the things that we put out into the world. And I'm very happy to have this connection here. Let me also welcome Seth Martell back to the show. Hi, Seth.
Morning, Chad. Morning, everybody. Seth Martell, he, him. You've probably heard me before on the show. I'm the writer and artist of The Mayor and other comic works, like the art for this show, Cyclops. This show,
the voice of Cyclops himself.
Yeah, so exciting. Whiny Cyclops.
We're recording tomorrow, and Seth has the whiniest, longest like monologue. It's so great.
Yeah, it's uncanny 96, and it is his whole opening is just a page of whining and feeling.
It's Cyclops.
It's Cyclops. Nice. Yeah, that. I'm also recently on the Lynn Ward Graphic Novel Prize jury for 2024. So this spring we'll be releasing the best graphic novel of 2024, which is pretty exciting. Last year, 2024. Nightcrawler, I actually was introduced to in Excalibur. So it was a very different Nightcrawler. He was a lot more self-confident in his self-possession and his powers. And his place on the team was a really fun space of joy and happiness and the contradictory of not looking like the average person, but still finding himself having the best time with that group, but also pining away for Megan, who was looking at the most traditionally handsome person. So he was a fun person and a place in that group. I really, really liked him there.
Lastly, I'm Chad Anderson. I use he/him pronouns. I'm the host of the show. I'm a former Marvel Comics handbook writer and an author and documentarian. I love Nightcrawler. I study the craft of writing quite frequently, and lately I've been on a deep dive into the stories behind the creation of the White Lotus series. I've been reading a lot of interviews and listening to things about like Mike White and how he will introduce these characters that are kind of awful, but he'll give them kind of a heart and like enough pathos to make you really care about them, even though they're all terrible people at the same time. It's interesting because one of the things I love most about writing anytime I'm reading is the idea of contradiction of character. I remember writing a prose piece one time about the idea of like, I love the supervillain who also likes to knit or who has a grandchild that they're raising. I like when we have contradictions. I like that Cyclops has a messy love life sometimes, even though he's the Boy Scout. Nightcrawler, almost more than any other X-Men character, I think exists in contradiction. He's the blue demon guy. He is the parishioner, or the Catholic part of him is alive. He's the swashbuckler. He's a hero. He's Spider-Man in the X-Men in a lot of ways. They even had an Uncanny Spider-Man series a few years ago. I think he's a delicious character. And today we get to delve deep into the sadder parts of his origin. He's also an orphan, which we'll be talking about as well today. So David, to open today's show, I would love for you to share with me and with our listeners a little bit about your origin story as a comic book fan, kind of turned comic book historian. I hope it's okay. I'm using that word to describe you. Well, I rarely see people dive as deep as I do into the lore of comics, and you're one of the top accounts that I've followed for years. It's kind of an honor to meet you, actually.
Thanks a lot, Chad. So I think I started as many others. I was a fan at my 11-year-old boy when I was really a child and, you know, struggling for things in growing up. And, well, I met the X-Men, and specifically I met the Claremont X-Men. That made a whole difference to me, the way that those characters behave and were, you know, fleshed out.
What was your first issue?
It was Uncanny X-Men 244, the one after Inferno, if I'm not wrong. You know, the latest night with Jubilee appearing. It's a very weird entry point to the Uncanny X-Men because, you know, it's not the typical superhero issue. But at the same time, we had classic X-Men running, and I think it was 18, issue number 18, with, you know, the classical battle against Magneto. So I have the two issues. And you may say, okay, I guess you were more attracted by the classic X-Men with Magneto and John Byrne and, you know, all this typical superhero stuff that happened. And it's a memorable issue after all. But no, I was more attracted to the other one because it was full of mystery. Who are those ladies? What is happening to them? And why they live in Australia? I mean, it was a lot of mysteries happening around, and I wanted to know more.
I think this is something every X-Men fan can relate to. When you're picking up the books, you want to know where they came from. And this is the era before the internet, where you have to go find back issues. And when you could see stories that would tell you where they came from, it really meant a lot. It's like getting your hands on season one of something, but you fell in love with it on season 30. You know what I mean? It's exciting.
Yeah. And I think Mr. Claremont defined it very well. I mean, he said that the comic books are the art of seeing what happens next and telling what is happening next. So it makes you want to know more. And that's the key of having a successful comic book, I would say. Right. So that really trapped me, and I wanted to know more, and I wanted to get back issues, but it was not easy. Anyway, I mean, so that was like how did I just met the X-Men back in my childhood or when I was a teenager. And I think that when Claremont left and the Uncanny X-Men stopped being what I was just a fan of, I tend to start disconnecting from the comic books, and specifically for Marvel Comics and the X-Men particularly.
So you're talking the early 90s when they split the book and ended the line.
Yeah, I think that, for instance, Scott Lobdell did a great job, but maybe I was not seeing the same tone in the X-Men that I knew, specifically after all the things that happened in Australia and next, right? But lately, I would say in the early 2010s and also 2020 after House of X, I started reconnecting to the comics again, but with a different angle, I would say. I wanted to know from an adult perspective, the whys and hows, right? I wanted to know more about the authors, the creators, the writers, the artists. I was wondering and making questions questions to myself, like, hey, if Claremont didn't left or hadn't left, how would the X-Men would look like? What was the plot that he was imagining for the X-Men? What would have been the Uncanny X-Men issue number 300, for instance? So those questions made me investigate and start researching. And of course, I'm a fan of X-Men, and I was a user of Instagram, so I wanted to communicate and be excited and connect to other people that felt the same.
So when did you launch this account? And it became really huge. At what point did you see the account? Like, at what point did you realize, oh, it's a big deal, this Instagram account?
Wow. Well, I think it's been live for more than 3 years. It was like early 2021 or 2022. And it started to get big when I started to answer in these questions that I was making to myself, right? So I was trying to ask to the followers if they knew any detail about, you know, what happened to Claremont and what was going on in the ex-office with Bob Harris and, you know, Jim Lee and this kind of things in 1991 that led to Claremont leaving the comic books that I loved. And I started a series of posts called Plots of Future Past, which was like a thematic series of stories, the saga that Claremont had in mind for the X-Men after he left, right? And this was pretty much successful. Everyone was like, you know, willing to know more. I think it's nostalgia after all, right?
So you seem to dwell firmly in that kind of nostalgia space, which is something I think Seth has in common with you a little bit. Seth and I talk a lot. Whenever I talk to Seth about 80s or early 90s stuff, he's like, fuck yeah, I love this stuff. But whenever I mention anything after like 2002, Seth's like, yeah, this isn't my stuff. And I think there's a certain amount of charm with that. Seth, do you want to talk about that? Like, you have imprinted on a certain era of X-Men and you love it with all your heart, but the modern stuff seems overwhelming a little bit, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I think two things about it, and it's interesting because I think I started and ended reading almost exactly around the same time Bobby did. And I think partially your curiosity had been satisfied with everything that came before it. We had time to invest in learning the lore and seeing they were like really building a whole new chapter that maybe wasn't actually intended for our age group anymore, where I think now coming back to what's happening, especially like when just around the Jonathan Hickman age and maybe a little bit before it, there started to become a lot more depth and nuance to the story, where they were leaning into nostalgia and lore and building very layered and thoughtful books again that were really exciting to read in a whole new spin that were, a new departure that like offered a whole new sense of curiosity. I thought that was really cool. And then it's grown really big. So right now I do have a hard time kind of figuring out like where to go and what to read. I think with the nostalgia factor, I think it's really fun to not only like lean into things that you enjoyed when you were younger, but then also like share that amongst other groups. You know, I think it's fun to share nostalgia.
The thing you're not stating for both of you, perhaps, is that you started and ended with Claremont, right? Claremont started with just the X-Men and it ran for a long time. And then it became Wolverine and then it became the New Mutants and then it became Excalibur. But Claremont had his hands on all of that stuff. When a different writer and editorial team took over X-Factor is where some fans really started to struggle. And then we fast forward a few more years and the line expands to the books are canceled, right? We now have a new launching of an X-Men title. We've got everything is kind of shifted around X-Factor with Peter David, X-Force under Liefeld and Nicieza. And it starts to get a little overwhelming. This is where we hit like Wolverine oversaturation overload that people speak about, you know? And it kind of is still there until like right around 2012. That big line expansion, it takes over the books for over 20 years. And there's a tremendous amount of dense continuity all through this. There's some gems along the way for sure. But you get that feeling, it's like, these aren't my X-Men anymore. And you have to like redefine it. When you're looking at Liefeld drawing Shatterstar and Feral on the page, you're like, who are these characters? And now they're beloved, but it's something that people have had to adapt to. With Krakoa getting canceled and a new line launched, I'm watching a whole generation of readers who've kind of lost interest in the new books, but there's a new generation of readers now picking up the new books as well. David, what are your thoughts on the post-Claremont continuity? Is it something that you've kept track of over the years? And then I would also love for you to share with people how you decided to make this beautiful book that you've put together.
Yeah, a lot of questions. But before answering them, I think you said something interesting there. I'm trying to be always positive about changes, right? So nostalgia is not about getting trapped in the past and not being able to be moving on. But I think it's also valuing what was making sense for people. But for instance, I was wondering when I was you know, investigating if fans also felt the same that I felt when Claremont left, when the new generation of X-Men came in Giant Size X-Men, or for instance, in the second generation of X-Men that Claremont did around the Mutant Massacre, this kind of thing. So I think that, I mean, we tend to be very aggressive when with changes, especially us that are, I mean, adult readers that have been there for a long time, but we need to be a little bit more patient, I would say, with changes.
Yeah, but this has always been there too. I'm diverting. Kurt Busiek, who's one of the scholars of like the Silver Age X-Men in the way that I am. Kurt has used a lot of X-Men continuity in his stories. There's a letter printed after Jean Grey died in the Dark Phoenix saga. There's a letter in an old book where Kurt Busiek's like, I'm quitting the X-Men now. How could you kill my favorite character? And this is one of the most prominent creators years later. This is something we've always gone through in this franchise.
I think he started even earlier saying that the Hellfire Club was like decadent and it was really awful to see those kind of lines in the X-Men books. That was fun, I mean, because, you know, everyone ends up loving the changing after a while.
Tell us how your book came to be. And I also am really curious what your day job is.
I'm a telecom engineer, so nothing to do with, you know, comic books or even writing. So it's about technology and networks. But, you know, I'm also used to communicate complex things to people that are not really experts. So I think that part of that is what I'm taking and putting together with when I write things, even if it's not about technology. In this case, it's about comic books. So about the book, you know, I've been like 2 years doing this kind of behind the scenes communication over Instagram. And I felt that Instagram is really nice because, you know, makes you reach a lot of people, but also it's not persistent, right? So in every moment, I mean, your account can get closed and all the work that you put there is off, right? It's away. So I wanted to maybe move into something that could be a legacy. So I started that project. It was really huge. I wanted to do a full review of the Claremont run. So the book will start with 1991, which is the year that I also almost started to be in the comic books, right? So I wanted to start with the end of the Claremont run, then the beginning, which is 1975, and then do a full review of the Claremont run through the biggest and peak moments of his tenure, right? But it turned out to be an immense project. So I thought that maybe focusing on just one of the parts will be a starter point. And I also was discussing with Berto Martinez, which is the illustrator of the book.
You know, yeah, and the paintings by Berto in this book are gorgeous. They're so beautiful.
Yeah, they are, to be honest. And I was impressed with, you know, his career. He's been working as a portraiter for many publications and in some fashion brands. And yeah, he just proposed me to use the paintings that he was doing, the watercolors, right, that he was doing for the X-Men. So I thought that maybe instead of doing this whole project, maybe we could focus on a book about the characters and their creation. For instance, the Giant Size X-Men characters and the beginning of the second Genesis. This is what the book is about, right? It's delving into this moment, the 1975 second Genesis, the all new X-Men. And it's also reviewing each one of the characters. This is where Berto's art kick in. Each one of the chapters of the book that has a character in it. It has also a watercolor that Berto did, right?
So I would love for, let's start with Nightcrawler, because that's where we're going to spend our time today. You have a chapter about Nightcrawler. What was it like for you to research the origins of this character? I know you reached out to some of the industry greats, some of the same people I've interviewed, some I haven't. What was it like for you to figure out how this character came to be?
Well, it was, I mean, I think it's a favorite of Dave Cockrum, and it is somehow like his avatar. So it was one of the key characters of the all new X-Men, and he was somehow the representation of the change that you know, that came in with the second Genesis and the Giant Size X-Men issue number one. So I had to read a lot of articles and interviews, and I was missing information, right? So I decided to contact Dave's widow, Patty Cockrum, that, you know, she's also a marvelous person, and also she was a staff in Marvel. She was a professional in comic books as well, right? So I was looking for her contact. I digging into a forum that is called, by the way, Nightcrawler. I don't know if you're familiar to it. No?
No.
It's an old forum, you know, that where Patty and Dave used to hang out with the fans, I would say. So I tried to get her contact through the forum, and she was super, super kind to me. She was answering all my questions and more than that. So I wanted to know more about Nightcrawler. To be honest, she wasn't there when Dave Cockrum created Nightcrawler, of course, but, you know, she has a lot of histories with Dave, etc., right? For instance, I would say that according to Patty, she was the one suggesting that, you know, the blue skin of Kurt Wagner is rather a velvet-like fur, right? So let's say she has a contribution to some of the aspects that define some of the character, right? Like Nightcrawler in this case. It was super interesting to interview her, and this was an essential part for me for the book, right?
What's something you discovered along the way in your research that really surprised you and changed maybe your understanding of how something came to be?
Well, something that is surprising to me is that Nightcrawler was created in 1968-1969 in a really hard storm night in the Pacific Island where Dave and his family were stationed, right? Were doing the service to the U.S. Navy. So it was kind of poetic to think that the same year that the original X-Men was cancelled as a title, there was a young artist imagining Nightcrawler that came to be one of the newest X-Men that will be part of the relaunch some years later. It was like, to me, coincidence, right? And it was pretty much interesting. And also, well, there are other aspects, like, for instance, he was part of a duo with a Punisher-like character called the Intruder, and Nightcrawler wasn't supposed to be a nice, was buckling, friendly people, an affable person. It was meant to be, you know, really mean, and it was to be demon-like in behavior as well, right? The typical guy that is you know, howling at the moon, running up walls, and these kind of things, doing weird things, you know?
Yeah, he's beautiful. You kind of expect him to be like a Marvel horror character, right? Especially with that name. You want him to be stalking. You expect him to be kind of like the DC character Gargoyle. He's like a guy that changes into a demon form almost.
Exactly.
But he's got a heart of gold, you know?
Yeah. He was supposed to be, you know, a demon that was from another dimension, like an alien dimension that, you know, was in a mission on Earth, and he screwed everything up. This is the story behind the design that Dave Cockrum did, of course.
Yeah. Do you want to share everyone what Dave's original name for Nightcrawler was?
Azazel. It's Baltasar or Bassasar or something like this. Baltasar, I think.
Yeah.
Do you remember it?
Azazel ends up being his dad.
Yeah. I got confused. It's Baltasar or Balsasar, I think it's pronounced. Baltasar.
I hope it's okay if I steer away from Nightcrawler for a minute. I think what's really interesting to anybody who takes on a project of this size, this is a very big project to wrangle a huge history of multiple writers, multiple characters, multiple points in time. When you started taking it on, did you think of format first, or did you let the research follow? Like, did you let the research shape how the book would actually become, or did you start researching to fill a certain structure of a book? Because it seems like a very intentional book, and it reads very well outlined. If that, you know, I think you've built it very well. And I was just curious: did you set out to make exactly this, or did you let your curiosity fill it up?
I think a mix of both things. I wanted the book to have a certain structure, like, you know, the first part is really delving in the behind the scenes story of how the new X-Men were conceived, right? And what was the driver behind it, you know, the International X-Men, and trying to get the title, the X-Men comic book, back from the cancellation state in which they were reprinting just old stories. That is like the first part, right? So I discovered during this process that I needed that to have a chronology, because from all the books that I had read so far and all the interviews, etc., it was not really clear to me when the concept of the all new X-Men started in Marvel offices. So I think it was as back as a premise, right? I started thinking that it was as back as 1972, that, you know, Roy Thomas together with Mike Friedrich and Dave Cockrum started to think about this book. Well, not Dave Cockrum, because he was not in Marvel at the time. Yeah, so I wanted to establish this chronology. This was not meant at the very beginning, but I thought it was super interesting because I found out how, you know, there was these conversations to get to the Giant Size X-Men finally, right? And also, something that I didn't plan initially was to investigate where were the X-Men in the fictional storyline in Marvel Universe where their series was cancelled, right? So I discovered there was this Lost Years or Hidden Years mutant saga where the X-Men characters appeared in other titles in Marvel. This was super interesting because I somehow got the connection in all the pieces that I didn't have in my mind, right?
Yeah, and so for listeners, that's what we spent 2024 on my show exploring. I spent a whole year exploring all that intro.
That's true, yeah. That's true, yeah.
When we are nerding out, we are all middle-aged men of a similar age, I think, and we have these pieces of our childhood that we connect to so deeply. Seth and I will be chatting on a given day. We have a free evening. Seth, what you doing? Oh, drawing X-Men. Chad, what you doing? Oh, reading some X-Men. Like, it's this. How did the two of you first come into contact? Because I know you have collabed on a few different Instagram posts.
I think this connects to what Seth was explaining on Nostalgia. I'm his number one fan. I really love his art.
Excuse me.
Maybe the second one.
We can be tied.
Yeah, of course. But when I started to look at Seth's art, I was impressed because he was conveying that feeling that I was back in the 80s reading the X-Men. You know, he captures the not only the characters, but also, you know, those little details that I really love. So I think that I started to have like favorite artists that I would just was willing to collaborate somehow from the Instagram account, right? And I think that was the way that we met, right, Seth?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and honestly, it was, you know, such a similar feeling of just, you know, reading, well, twofold for me. Not only was I reading your post and enjoying like a deep dive on so many things I was not only curious about, but had like a point in reference and time in my life. It was like, you know, kind of like a instantly like a drug dealer just laying out things for me. I'm like, ooh, I can read about that. I would like to read that. Like, that's very interesting. So it kind of hooks you with like, it not only hits the nostalgia and interest for me, but then a wonderful deep dive that you start going into, which is very much similar to your book. I mean, I think that there's just, it's such an easy book to pick up, read a little bit and kind of get lost in. You can put it down and pick it back up again. I really love that. But the other part is that during my day job, I'm a graphic designer, but for a while I had to take over my company's Instagram and all their social accounts, really. Now I have a social media manager and my life is much better and she's amazing. But when I had to manage it, I realized the time and thoughtfulness that was being put into this account. And I believe you're on quite a few accounts, and it takes a ton of planning to be thoughtful and successful. And I just knew how much work and care was going to these accounts. So I was very excited to collaborate because I knew it wasn't just a quick and hasty person like making this daily content up. It's a very, very well planned and thoughtful piece of temporary work that you can absorb very quickly in your life and then get like a little shot of dopamine of nostalgia and fun things that you love. I think it's really smartly done.
Yeah.
It can be a full-time job if you let it. Right?
It could be. I mean, but I think that this is something that we do passion and love. And that's the important thing about it. I mean, it takes time, but it's something that you do as a hobby, right? Maybe instead of reading so much comic books now, what I do is reading comic and investigating them. Maybe, as you were saying, right, Ted, what are you doing this afternoon? Well, I'm reading this issue. I'm investigating this thing that I just came to my mind and I wanted to learn more about that.
It can be a very slippery slope some days, right? And you're like, just curious because you have a couple minutes and you start doing something, and then all of a sudden you're like, I've been doing this here for an hour.
I treat this show like a full-time job. I'll research for 7, 8, 9, 10 hours or write for that long sometimes. It's crazy. David, I don't know what your personal life is like, if you have a spouse or a partner or kids. How has it been for your loved ones to see you put this book out? And what's the fan reaction to the book been like?
Well, my partner, I mean, he's more geeky than me. Maybe he's more into the MCU and movies this time, and also gaming, but we have a lot of gadgets, Marvel gadgets around the house. And he was, of course, supporting me a lot, right? And, you know, doing a book is for some time, time consuming, a lot of time that you need to devote to investigate and put it together. So you need to, I mean, your family, your personal surrounding needs to be supportive and also understand that you need this time to do it. So yeah, it's amazing to come with this kind of support.
Yeah, my husband wants to know what's going on in my life. So I have to share just enough, or he feels like we're too far away. But if I share one fact too many about the X-Men, he's like, all right, I don't need to know anymore. Like,
but is he a fan as well? Or
not? Nope, he hates it. I don't think he's ever listened to a single episode of the show, even though he's been on it a couple times.
I think my case is different because we see at the same, we take a look from different angles, right? So this is complementary. We can go to the cinema together and watch a movie, a Marvel movie, or maybe we can see the latest thing on the Disney Plus, whatever. I'm more devoted to the academic part of the comic book industry, let's say. It's more than entertainment.
Yeah, fully understood. So a minute ago, Seth, you had two of your friends fighting over who was your biggest fan, and I saw you kind of roll your eyes and go, this again? No response. It's just shaking his head in shame.
I am just always thrilled to work with people who are thoughtful writers who also enjoy all the aspects that excite me when I am bored or need to fulfill that creative urge or curiosity or, you know, fill a space and feel constructive. I think that that's like a big part of why I really enjoy working with people like both of you. You know, it's finding people who want to not make it a chore, but find delight in where they're going with their free time, you know. Be constructive and have a good time. That's a really important thing.
Talented, friendly, nerdy people. Through this show, I have built a whole community of individuals like ourselves, and it has changed my life, really, truly. There's something really special. Going to the Uncanny Experience in July, I'm so excited about it. It's an entire group of people who are just so happy to be there. And that's how I feel every time I make this show. It's wonderful. Before we transition, David, who are your favorite characters, your favorite heroes, your favorite villains?
Difficult to choose. Well, the villains are clear. I mean, it's Magneto. Magneto is my... By the way, we always have this controversy, at least here in Europe. It's Magneto or Magneto? How do you say it?
I mean, we say Magneto, but I think a lot of people outside of America pronounce it Magneto.
Magneto. Okay.
Shout out to Derek Tunskin. We have a big debate about this early on in my show.
And as for favorite characters, it's difficult to choose just one, but I would say the classic ones from the classic X-Men, especially I would say Storm, Wolverine, Nightcrawler, maybe Rogue or Kitty Pryde will be in the list, Cyclops and Jean Grey. It's difficult to choose just one.
Yeah, you have one villain and 1,200 heroes.
Yeah.
Seth, who are your
and
favorites?
It's not really a villain, I would say, right? It's always in the gray.
Sure. Seth, who are your favorite?
It's all about the mix, because I think everything about the X-Men, you know, the silly tropes of saying like, oh, they're a family, but it's like, it's all about like the group that you create based on who you put them with for a reason. Is it a mission? Is it playing a game of baseball? Are they going out? Are they, you know, what kind of challenge are they up to? That interesting mix of people is what makes them interesting. And finding that perfect balance of a group is also super, super fun.
And how about your favorite villains?
I think like everybody said, it's so fun to start with Magneto because he's such a gray area. And then, you know, I also love to also hate Mr. Sinister because he is interesting and there's a lot of depth and he can go. He's ridiculous and over the top. But I know Chad also really likes so much of his history and what he can do.
Sinister? I hate Sinister. Sinister's really fun, but Sinister is a lot. But this is an interesting parallel, because when I think of Sinister, I think of Joel Grey from Cabaret as like the MC. If you guys have seen the old musical, he's up on the stage, Liza Minnelli's in it. He's introducing the numbers. He's a little bit queer. He's got a little bit of a limp wrist. There's a cane and a top hat, and it's all a performance. I also think of that, that has a strong parallel for Nightcrawler. I think Nightcrawler has this kind of showman side. He puts a hat on and gets a cane out and he's ready to do a tap dance, right? But I think, of course, he's more Errol Flynn. Who do you guys think of when it comes to Nightcrawler? Physicality, voice, does anyone come to mind?
I would say maybe Tom Selleck, but also Errol Flynn works super fine and also has been always there mentioned. So it's difficult to evade from Errol Flynn.
I think it's funny that you brought up the MC. I haven't seen the original Cabaret, but Cabaret, when it got the revival, was Alan Cumming who played him in the movie.
Did you like Alan Cumming's makes sense. Nightcrawler?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I think he's very, very good because he plays them with, you know, a wink and a nod. You know, like he has a sense of humor and self-deprecation and also he's in on the joke the whole time. But, I think he was the perfect person to play him. I don't know about the movie itself being perfect, but I thought he was great casting. And it's almost kind of like somebody else had that same thought that you did.
I think as far as writers go, I also wanted to ask this. It's hard to get Nightcrawler right. I think a lot of people understand one part of Nightcrawler. And we're going to talk about this in the issue today. We see these writers really latching on to the idea of Nightcrawler as the misfit or the victim. But I think it's so hard to get him right. It's that delicate balance. Certain writers will do all priest stories. For certain writers, it's all swashbuck. Some writers seem to not know what to do with him. Cy Spurrier has had his hands on Nightcrawler for the last several years and has been doing incredible work in the Krakoan era. Gail Simone's currently working with Nightcrawler now, and I'm kind of waiting for a moment. Like, Uncanny X-Men's been coming out for about 10 issues, and Nightcrawler hasn't done much yet. So that's kind of what I mean. Do you guys have any favorite Nightcrawler writers or artists? Who gets him right for you?
Well, I think Alan Davis is a definitive writer plus artist. But of course, Dave Cockrum as an artist, we need to consider him because he's creator and he's also his avatar, I would say, in the comic books, right? I think it's no surprise I'm a big fan of Chris Claremont.
It's interesting now that, you know, we're doing these readings of, you know, X-Men from, you know, like 1975 on, because you see the early hand of Cockrum trying to kind of figure out these people too. Like from panel to panel, you're like, oh, that's not what they look like. I think he's figuring out a character's voice of physicality as he goes, because sometimes Nightcrawler's eyes are wildly insane, or like Storm's cheekbones are really super high. But I think it's interesting Nightcrawler really does get settled in as he builds him, and then it's like the clay kind of is like getting molded by Cockrum, and then Byrne fires it into such a cohesive three-dimensional character. Like it's interesting how it got handed off to John Byrne, who he's like essentially like so unmoved. It's like no one even tries to really give him a new costume for more than like 5 minutes, because he's just such a fully formed character at this
point. Claremont, I think it takes him a minute to get Nightcrawler. This is interesting. So Nightcrawler first shows up in 1975. And Divi, do you want to talk a little bit about Nightcrawler's introduction? The way he shows up on the page for the first time with the mob torches?
I mean, have you ever read Frankenstein from Mary Shelley? Because I think the parallelism is there. And that's the vibe to me. I mean, it's Frankenstein in comic books, right? So if you remember, he's in Bavaria in a really small town with, you know, lots of superstitious people around. And I love the moment that Charles Xavier appears and do the trick of freezing everybody. This was the trick that we really start to appreciating with the movies, I would say, with the Fox movies. You know, this trick that Xavier just kicks in and do the magic and everyone is calming down. So I think they are the first pages in Giant Size X-Men, and I think they are there for a reason, right? Because it's really impressive the way that a comic book starts with a Frankenstein vibe, and then we have the Charles Xavier entrance.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion. Or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Families agents. Life's better when you're under American Families roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
So we see some things right from the beginning. He's misshapen. He looks demonic. The crowd is shouting things at him like demon. There's burning torches. Nightcrawler climbs to the top of a church. It gets burned down and he falls to the ground below, where they're ready to kill him before Xavier zaps all their brains and says, look, I'm going to offer you a place. Why don't you come and live with me? That was 1975. Now, Claremont quickly gives us the playful Errol Flynn swashbuckling Nightcrawler. He introduces Amanda Sefton or Jermaine Shardos pretty quickly. So we get Nightcrawler as kind of a sex symbol and a hero. But it's not until 1980 with X-Men Annual number 4, which is where we get Nightcrawler's kind of definitive origin. There's one line in a comic book when he first meets Mystique, and they're like, oh, we look alike. But in this particular issue, we meet Margali Shardos. Now, in the very first appearance, Nightcrawler is running away from what he calls Der Jahrmarkt, which is basically German for the carnival. You get the idea that it was kind of a freak show. He was an acrobat. He was a performer. But we don't get a lot about that. In X-Men Annual number 4 is when we get that backup story where we see more of his childhood. His mother, Margali, is a witch. She has like a horned hat and green skin, and her visual is delicious. She's kind of bound to the Winding Way, which anyone who's seen Agatha All Along, like, there's something very magical about this kind of witch energy with Margali. Margali has two natural children. We do not know who their father is. Stefan and Jemaine. Jemaine becomes Amanda Sefton, magic day tripper later. And we get this kind of odd backstory where Kurt is the adopted son in a Romani family who are working as circus performers in kind of a freak show, basically. And Stefan, for some reason, has always felt like he has a dark side. And it's like, only in a couple of panels, but in that issue, we get the idea that Stefan asked Kurt at a certain point, if I ever turn evil, then I want you to kill me. And then we kind of flash forward and we see that Kurt accidentally killed Stefan during a moment of conflict after Stefan had gone dark. Now, that's not super followed up on. In fact, Stefan only has a couple of appearances, but we do know that Margali has some extremely complicated ethics. She does dark things and light things in equal measure, depending on where her magic is that day. So she may do something sweet for Kurt or something terrible, which is oddly kind of Mystique's character, depending on what her motivations are as well. So Kurt's connection to Margali is revealed in 1980. Then we start to get more of the complexity of this character as he has more vulnerability, the idea of him as an orphan, not just a misfit, but his determination to be a hero, a sex symbol. And then we get the church stuff added on as another layer later on. Uncanny Origins has an issue of Nightcrawler's origin that gives Nightcrawler and the Stefan story a little bit of attention as well. But basically, Nightcrawler ends up running from the circus during a particular day because we're led to believe he killed Stefan and now the people have turned against him. They see him as a demon and now he's running into the village. The last thing I'll say here before we kind of sum up this part of the conversation. Most of the portrayals of Kurt's childhood, Seth, we got to talk about Excalibur -1 on the show, for example. They're portrayed as pretty happy. Nightcrawler's hopping around the circus. He's on the trapeze. He's flirting with his foster sister, who is not blood related, so it's okay, technically. He has a pretty happy childhood, even though he is a misfit. He gets to live his best life out in the public eye, doing things that he loves. So this issue we're about to read really leans heavily into trauma instead of happy, and it's a rough read in a little bit, and I'm not quite sure how these issues stack together. David and then Seth, do you have thoughts on kind of the exploration or additions to Nightcrawler's origins over the years before we jump into today's issue?
I think they are a little bit confused, but the good thing I would say is they are always around the same, you know, characters and storyline, right? So we know that Mystique is mother to, or the father in this case, the mother to Nightcrawler, and there's a relationship there with Destiny.
I'll get to that part in the next section.
Yeah, brilliant. And Margali Shardos and Jemaine and Stefano are always there. And the mob and, you know, the chasing, the freak, the circus, those elements are always there. The difficult thing to me is with all the retcons or the detailing adding that has been across the years, it's not difficult to say what is actually the best canon that we could have. I don't know, what do you guys think about this? I mean, because it's like we have different stories. For instance, for some years, Azazel was the father, and that has been retconned to the Claremontian origin, let's say, of Nightcrawler with Destiny and Mystique. But Azazel still is there for a reason. So I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, so let me address this out loud really quickly. We'll do the quick continuity dive here. So Claremont always intended for Destiny and Mystique to be Nightcrawler's parents. They are, of course, Rogue's foster parents. And we later get Mystique is the mother of Graydon Creed. Fucking Charles Xavier Jr. is her baby that exists out there somewhere in the world. Anyway, We get kind of odd origins because Mystique doesn't seem to remember this. And the relationship, the queerness of Mystique being kind of a transgender character, or using old terminology, a gender-bending character, if she's able to sprout a penis and have sex with a woman and become this child's father, but really she's mother because she's biologically female, they just wouldn't let that happen. Even the lesbian relationship was too much. But in the early 90s, I've actually done a script reading of this issue on my show, in X-Men Unlimited number 4 is where we finally get get the retcon, that Mystique was living in like a German town, married to like a count. She had his child. And later when they exposed her, Frankenstein style, they chased her down and she threw the baby off of the waterfall, which is when Margali found it. Now, fast forward another 30 years, it's only in the Krakoan era where we get to acknowledge Mystique and Destiny, like actively as lovers, as wives. We see a lot more of their history delved out. And then we get the very recent retcon, and it's very smartly written. It's very careful to get all the details. In X-Men Blue Origins, that takes everything we've talked about, plus the Chuck Austin story from the early 2000s, where he tells us a story that's very hated by a lot of X-Men fans, that a very old mutant, Azazel, who has red skin and who is teleporting, has fathered like many demon teleporting children in effort to like build a base of power. Azazel is like hundreds of years old. And so we take this character Nightcrawler and we make his literal father a demon and his mother a shapeshifting supervillain. It's not until X-Men Origins Blue by Cy Spurrier where we get to see all of the story finally fleshed out. Mystique is Nightcrawler's father and Destiny is the birth mother. And Mystique is married to that like German count. Destiny has had a prophecy of the future where Azazel is going to take over the world unless they do this thing to stop him. And they don't toss Nightcrawler over a waterfall. Instead, they arrange for him to be raised by Margali because Destiny has seen that that's necessary for the future. Then Charles Xavier deletes their memories of this, only to be discovered now in 2023 is when I think that book came out. It makes it all work. It's very heartfelt. It's very sweet. And Spurrier did his homework. But yes, addressing Nightcrawler's parentage is a huge part of this conversation as well.
Okay, but what are the BAMFs? What are the BAMFs? Where do they come from? What even, why? What are they?
They're connected to the Brimstone dimension. Nightcrawler briefly passes through another dimensional space whenever he lands in our world. And then there's little creatures called BAMFs that are originally designed as like little impy guys who, I don't know, it's like a toy line, right? Like they made stuffed dolls. There's that infamous image of Nightcrawler naked with the BAMF over his crotch, like waiting for Amanda, right? Like, but we also had like things like Kitty's Fairy Tale. So in the Marvel Universe, whenever a story is told, that's a literal other reality. Like we've created a story and it exists somewhere out there in the multiverse. We have multiple stories where BAMFs are part of those stories. When Nightcrawler dies during the Bastion, like Sentinel Utopia story, he comes back, he's like revived from heaven and he's made out of like angelic BAMFs and they like hop around him. One of them is named Pickles and like joins a full X-Men team for a while. So the BAMFs are a lot of different things. Divi, do you have thoughts on
this? Oh, God. I'm still trying to figure out how does this Baron, I think it was a Baron Wagner, fits into the story together with Father Wagner, which is the priest that also appears in Nightcrawler's story. So I'm trying to figure out how everything fits together. And also it says as Mystic lover, or I mean,
yeah, as and Mystique did have sex. That's stated on the page. It's very clear that Mystique and Destiny have an open relationship, and they both like men and women, which is great. But we also get the idea that, or the German count that that Mystique was married to is also Wagner. So that name can come from either place.
I guess it's a common name, right, in Germany. Everyone is Wagner at some point.
Yeah. All the German Wagners.
Like Smith or Garcia here in Spain. Yeah, everyone is Garcia, so I guess somehow it doesn't matter.
Two guesses. Seth, who do you think created the Brimstone dimension, the place that Nightcrawler teleports to?
Oh, no idea.
Chuck Austin. Past my age. It's Chuck Austin. He's the one that names the Brimstone dimension during the Azazel story. And, of course, Chris Claremont himself created the little BAMF guys. Are you guys BAMF fans? I think they're annoying. They're like the minions of the X-Men.
You know, there's some notes in Dave Cockrum's, by the way, in his notebook of characters that says that there's an alien dimension where Nightcrawler is coming from. So it's not named as Brimstone, but there was some concepts already in the very beginning, right? Sure. Back to the 60s.
Okay, last question before we jump in. What's your thoughts on the Kurt and Amanda relationship?
Oh, with this continuity, it's a little bit weird now because, you know, they are like family after at all, but
not blood.
No, you're right, and it wouldn't be a problem after all, right? Because I mean, we live in a free world, and everyone is free to do whatever they want. But yeah, Amanda Sefton is one of my favorite characters in the X-Men as a supporting cast, because she's bringing another magic different to what we see, for instance, with Ileana Rasputin, right? In fact, I really love the Mural Island new X-Men from, you know, the Silvestri run, if you remember, mm-hmm. the short-lived team that Forge and Banshee put together, and Amanda was part of that. Mm-hmm. And I really love how she was portrayed. So about her relationship to Nightcrawler was sweet at the beginning, and I have hoped that would be longer. But yeah.
Seth?
I mean, that ship sailed. You can't really change anything about it, so just let it be, right?
I think it's fine, actually. The Piotr Kitty one is the one that makes me more uncomfortable, because Kitty's like a young teen, and he's an adult teen, and that one makes me more uncomfortable. Kurt also, by the way, and I'll just mention this quickly in passing, a lot of portrayals of his origin show him as part, like his traveling carnival was populated by like super-powered performers. There's guys like Haus and Führer and Gumi is like the contortionist, but they all have powers, and there's stories where they come back into Kurt's life. But mostly, we see Margali working in the circus as like a fortune teller, which is the Romani kind of myth, where Kurt and Amanda are the acrobats. Today's story is a very different version of that. So we're going to jump in. So X-Men Origins Nightcrawler comes out in May 2010. There were multiple one-shots under the label X-Men Origin, including the recent one we covered on my show with Colossus and one about Wolverine recently as well. The title of this issue is Nativity. This is an era in the books when the X-Men are on Utopia. They're an endangered species, and we're really trying to get back in touch. Nightcrawler dies shortly after all this, right? So this is a tough era. That was a sad death, by the way. That was very sad. The writers on this book are Adam Freeman and Mark Bernardin. The pencilers, Kerry Nord and James Herron. The colorist is Chris Sotomayor, and the letterer is Dave Sharp. The editor is Nick Lowe and Daniel Ketchum. Now, I know a lot of people, but I don't know any of these creators. Kerry Nord does most of the pencils in this book. Seth, what are your thoughts on Kerry Nord's pencils, and do you want to tell us about the cover of this book?
Sure. I mean, I know Kerry Nord. I don't know James Herron. Kerry Nord does some really beautiful work, and I actually think it's very pretty. I don't know if it's inked, though. It looks like someone just colored over really heavy pencils.
Interesting.
Very pretty. Chris Soto is, you know, such a talented colorist. They've been doing work for so long, especially like in DC, but they've really created this like kind of painterly look to this piece. Very pretty. I think it's amazing that two different artists did it, because they worked very hard to look similar. I don't know. I would assume that the second artist had to pick up for some slack of the first one not getting this done on deadline, or maybe it was just asked for really quickly. You know,
yeah.
You never know what happens behind the scenes. It's very, very pretty. I like that the flashback is, you know, colored in muted tones. I think there's like some really beautiful art choices, some like heavy slash paint colors on, you know, their highlights. I think it's really nice.
Nightcrawler is lithe. His skin runs dark blue, turning black into shadow. He has fur, but it's like very loose, tight fur. I almost think of like an otter's fur that kind of like slacks down tight against the body. He has two elongated fingers and thumbs and toes. He's got his forked tail, and then he's got yellow eyes, pointed ears, kind of a little bit of a fanged mouth. He's very lithe, very lean. We often think of him in action poses, like teleporting with a sword in his head, right? I love when an artist does Nightcrawler in repose like this. But the art on my wall of Nightcrawler by Dotuna Conde is Nightcrawler standing with his tail wrapped around, looking down while he's on the side of a church, you know? So it's a really beautiful image, but it kind of conveys the loneliness of this character. I wish Nightcrawler were bigger in it, though. It's not my favorite cover of all time. When we open this book, we go back to Nightcrawler's origins. The story is called Nativity. We see a very young Nightcrawler. Now, he was found by Margali as a baby. We do not know where this story fits exactly into his continuity, but he's kind of being tried out for a new circus. You almost have to wonder if Margali like really fell on some hard times, or if there's like a time in her relationship with the Winding Road where she's at the bottom. She seems to be a very powerless character here, and is doing nothing to support her children or to protect herself from a very abusive man. And it's kind
she
of
looks really fragile.
Yeah. You almost wonder if she's like at a spot in her life where she just doesn't have any power, because we see her much more powerful in other places.
It's weird because, you know, it's funny that you said it was in 2010. I thought this was a lot older. I thought this like 2001, like back when people didn't care about continuity enough, because this doesn't merit, like the book doesn't merit its storyline if it doesn't explain like why she's in this position, you know, or why they're in this place. It just kind of feels like a new person writing a Nightcrawler origin really quickly based on what they know from either watching an X-Men movie or the like giant size X-Men number one, and that's it. It doesn't feel like there's enough, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Remember how I said Nightcrawler loved the circus, loved performing. It's his favorite thing. We get a very different version of that story here. We open on like a big top full of people. The crowds are like, every seat is taken kind of. They're all pointing. Nightcrawler is hopping around and being amazing. It says Kurt Wagner, beautiful, graceful, but there's something otherworldly to his movements and to the emptiness behind his eyes. The ringmaster yells, "The flying fiend, the magnificent monster, the daredevil demon. Call it what you will, ladies and gentlemen. We call it amazing. Only at Air Getman's Traveling Menagerie." There's a different versions of the circus story. I'll do an episode on Der Yarmark sometime on the character channel. But Kurt is very, very sad as the performance ends, the lights go out, and suddenly we have a very different thing happening, right? So Max Getman is the owner of the circus. Margali Shardos is here. He is gripping her arm tightly. This man has something over her. It's very the abusive man with the abused woman. And we also meet a guy that's never shown up again named Rolf Gecht, or the strong man. Kurt looks up and sees the night sky through the open big top, and he longs for freedom. He's called before the ringmaster, or the owner, Getman, who then calls in a man named Doc Mojo, who's wearing this green plaid suit and a bow tie. He's gross. And he comes in with a shot. "Time for your medicine, boy." Kurt complains as they inject him with something. It burns. And then they put him unconscious, because they've sedated him, into an animal cage on a pile of hay, like in between the tigers and the lions and the bears that are also kept for the circus. It's very, very sad in that way. We get Kurt kind of mumbling in his pain. He gets a German phrase here that means God will judge you. And the strong man who throws him in there says, "Really? Study your reflection, my friend. It appears God has judged you as well." David, how does this version of Kurt's life match up to what you know about this character?
No, it's super sad. It's heartbreaking to see him treated as an animal. And yeah, it's totally different from the swashbuckling acrobat. He was happy in the circus. He always tells stories about the circus. I don't think this is fitting really, as you guys said, right? This is not marrying well with the past stories. So, however, the comic book so far, I think that conveys pretty much the atmosphere that you want to have, right, for this kind of story. And maybe that's part of the colorist work, as Seth was saying. Chris Sotomayor here is doing an excellent job,
yeah,
you know, to create this sadness, this atmosphere, this heaviness, right?
If they've chosen to tell a particular version, and if, you know, if this is continuity, it might just be a portion of Kurt's life where a lot of the other stuff was happy. And again, I think we can tie the winding road in to make sense. Almost my favorite thing in this entire book is what happens next. Kurt is in his cage, and it's very subtle, but he's decorated this little cage with a flower that he has tied to one of the bars that is now dying. He's got his own poster, you know, advertising Air Getman's Flying Fiend. He also has a picture of his mother and a cross. So the fact that he's in this like lonely environment, but he's decorated with little mementos, is a very, very thoughtful touch to his book. As he wakes up, his mother, Margali, is making some stew for Getman, who is furious. He just dumps it out on the ground and like is ready to like punch her in the face. She's like, no, I'll make you some more. It's fine. This is very how my stepfather treated my mother. I do not like scenes like this. It's very
terrible
to see. And it's a weird characterization for Margali completely. So she needs to make some new Sauerbraten, which is a German beef dish. And we see her children, Jermaine and Stefan, here very briefly, but that's kind of all they feature into the story. We don't really see much of them otherwise. So they are acknowledged. Margali walks over to Kurt's cage and he's weak. He's muttering, "The world has been spinning for so long, I don't know what is real anymore." And she says, "I know, my dear. It's the poison making you weak." "Mother?" "Yes, my love." "Tell me again about our life before this place. Its words warm my heart." Seth, do you want to tell us a little bit about the story that she tells? It's a very fairy tale version, but the images don't match what she's saying.
It's the classic story of Mystique throwing him off the cliff into the river. I just don't understand, like, the origin of Kurt originally. Like, he would never even need medicine. Poison, you know, like injected in him because he would be loyal to his family and respect the circus. Like it's not his personality at all. Like he wouldn't need to be drugged because he would be so trusted and such an obedient, good person. So it's such a...
Yes. However, that was me as a kid. I would have done whatever was asked and I still got hit across the face. You know what I mean? Like I get that part of the story, I guess, in a way. And in this version, Mystique doesn't throw him off the waterfall. We see her running from torches and she like collapses at the side of a river. You almost wonder if Kurt just like got swept away on a log, because there's no attempt to scare him.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I really kind of looked like she just was like, "Wah."
It's subtle art, but it's kind of deftly handled. And again, that never happened in the retcon. The story we get is your birth mother was beautiful from a respected family of wealth and power. She fell in love with a good, hardworking man of lesser means. Her father did not approve. He cast her out. A brave, wise woman. She sought out a safe home for you. Such a precious, precious child. People came from across the land in search of you. They all wanted this miracle baby to join their family. But mothers, we always know what is best. And your mother chose me. So it's this like beautiful adoption story. But the captions tell us, as these like people with torches are chasing Mystique, that even Kurt knows these are lies. Like the words she's saying are lies, but he prefers them to the truth. David, did you have thoughts on this retcon?
I think it's a classic story after all, right? I mean, trying to convey drama and try to add some fantasy. Like, you know, clearly the teenager Kurt is going through pain and he needs some help from his foster mother to have sweet words, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They need to use imagination to calm him down, right? And make his life easier within the cage.
There are many ways to tell a Romani character's story and be so offensive and so wrong. And these days, even the word gypsy is not really socially acceptable, right? The worst part of this story for me is that we Christianize and whitewash like Margali's experience culturally. We kind of see her almost as like a Christian woman who's adopted a baby. So we get people yelling, that baby's an abomination. And she's like, he is of God, as we all long to be, which is just not the Romani style.
I don't think so.
Romani readers, I think, would be very displeased by this characterization of this woman who's just there to be abused. But she's like the doting mother character who still knows her child isn't being abused and not doing anything to stop it. So we get the idea that because she has this quote unquote devil child, she needed to go find a place. And listen to the Christian methodology here. Your siblings and I set out to find a home worthy of such a gift, and God delivered one to us. So she walks into this like carnival where she's now being beat by this man. And that is not what God wanted for this family. Not obviously. Then she doesn't believe in God in that way. So that part is the worst part of the story for me. Seth, do you want to tell us about a little boy Nightcrawler, the sinister blue devil in a cage?
I mean, I think what Carrie Nord needs to be given credit for is it's very hard, very, very difficult to draw different ages of younger characters. I mean, I think we've all seen the terrifying children that John Byrne draws. And these are beautiful, age-appropriate children and very expressive faces. Nightcrawler is just so heartbreakingly sad in the portraiture of his different emotion. Well, really, his emotion is sad. But just one emotion, sad. But they're really, really absolutely gorgeous and thoughtful renderings of an abused teen character, sadly.
My favorite character in this whole book is in this panel with the sinister blue devil. If you look to his right, there is a bearded woman in a sassy pink dress. She has her hips out. She has her elbow cocked. I love this bearded lady. I want to know more. I bet she and Kurt were friends. They talk through the bars all the time. So the kids come in. They are screaming about like this disgusting creature is not doing anything. And that gets back to Ergetman. So this child's in a cage. He then pulls like little boy Kurt into the back room and starts literally whipping him. And obviously this guy's a bad guy, but he's saying, I take in your gypsy whore of a mother. And this is how you thank me. I do not run a boarding house. I run a business. And in business, you must. And he's whipping. Kurt starts jumping around. He breaks some shit. And Getman realizes, oh, I've got a performer here. I can beat this child and make him jump around. And then people will pay me more money. So this version of the story implies that Kurt was in this situation for years and years. And I don't know how we reconcile it with his original origin story. It's a little bit rough.
And how do you think, I mean, about this Getman? The portrayal of him doesn't look really fear, right? Fierce. He's like more like a cleric, or, you know, like...
Yeah, he's like a little balding kind of pot-bellied man with glasses and like a broom handle mustache. And Margali could fucking kick his ass if she wanted to.
Sure.
So we are back in...
Not really scary, I would say, right?
No. But that's almost what makes him more scary too, right? Like little white men who think they have a lot of power over their wives and kids. I know the type. It was in my family. Okay, so we jump back to the present, and Getman is ready to get rid of Kurt. Basically, like, he's too much trouble, he says. And he tells Margali he would fetch me a handsome price from another carnival or a taxidermist. Holy shit. Like, that's...
Wow.
He called her a gypsy whore, and now he wants to send Kurt to a taxidermist. So Margali summons a little kid who his name is Armin Freilich, who says is Getman's whipping boy. So this is another child being beat, right? Like the little roustabout kid. And they realize that Getman's going to do something really bad. So the kid gets Margali a shovel. She says, run away so you don't get into trouble. And then she uses the shovel to break open Kurt's cage. Kurt says, I won't go. I won't abandon you. I won't leave you in his hands. He'll kill you. And she says, no, he won't. We offer enough to the surface to make this go well. You have to do as we say. Mothers, we know best, which is a reference to her earlier story. So Kurt jumps away, and there's a fire that spreads behind him, and Getman is fucking furious. He sends a mob after the child, who is starting to run. As Kurt gets into the woods, he collapses, and we have some people who come over him. There's whips. They're clearly intending to lynch him. They corner him. A gun is pointed directly at his face with the threat to shoot. He's called names, and it's this moment when they're going to kill him when his powers activate. Bamf! Pink cloud. He jumps away. Getman looks horrified and astonished, and Kurt's like, fuck yeah, and goes off to find somewhere to live. I just summed up a lot at once, but David, what are your thoughts on the activation of Kurt's powers in this scene?
Well, at this moment, we learn that he is 13 years old or something like this, right? Because up to now, we didn't know exactly what was his age. On the other hand, I really love this panel where he's smiling with his fangs just appearing. It reminds me of you know, the visual imagery of the X2 Fox movie where he was smiling like this. I really love that panel. Like, hey, I have a power. He's like happy in his head life. He's starting to smile. The very first smile that we see in the
comic book. Because it tells us on page one, there's a sadness behind his eyes, right? But here he is free. He was longing to be out and he had to leave his family to do it. So queer analogy, I think all of us identify as queer. We grow up in a place where they tell us what we have to be. It's a literal cage. And when we get out, we get to smile and figure ourselves out. We always love those stories, and Kurt represents that for us. Kurt ends up at a church. There is a man here named Father Wagner. You almost wonder if Kurt didn't know a last name before this, even though the German count's name was Wagner. But after he he chose the name Wagner for himself, perhaps. I don't know exactly. But this is very Les Miserables, right? Like Jean Valjean's out of prison and the guy in the church takes him in. The priest is astonished. Like, here's this blue guy. But he immediately says, there's a blanket. You can come stay with me. I will feed you. And then in a kind of a montage where I'm assuming like Amazing Grace is playing in the background in the film version, we get a lot of Kurt being instructed in the ways of the church. So this is an interesting thing. And I'd love to hear both of your opinions. We just talked about how Margali is very Romani, right? Clearly not Christian, but Kurt is Christian. Kurt's Catholic. So this part of the story makes sense to me in a way where we have him leaving his family tradition and discovering a different tradition for himself, because he really loves this life. Like the ritual of the church, the belief in the higher power, these are integral parts of Nightcrawler's character.
I don't know what he's drinking in the first panel. I grew up going to Catholic school, and is he drinking holy water? That's weird. Yeah.
I don't, what's weirder is the way the priest is smiling at him while he's
True. I mean, it looks demonic.
It's bizarre. But I mean, I guess it's an account of him finding a peaceful home and feeling safe. And I guess that's a nice thing for him, right? To have a person who actually is caring for him instead of poisoning him every night.
Yeah. The scriptures we see quoted during this montage, judge not that ye be not judged. Who are you to judge someone else's servant? To his own master he stands or falls. Never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they they will see God in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So a lot of like religious instruction, and Kurt's painting the ceilings and he's putting on a little bit of weight and he's starting to feel good. But then here comes that little kid from the circus, Armin, who's been fleeing Getman and is running to safety. He's clearly been beat. His face has lacerations on it. And now Getman is here with the torches and all his men, including that strong man. The priest, Father Wagner, steps forward and they strike him across the face with a torch. And they're ready to just burn the place down and kill everyone within. This is very Disney cartoon in a certain way. They are calling Kurt devil. He is now figuring out how to bamf. He gets Armin to safety. The church is now fully on fire. And this is the moment where he finally realizes he can fight back. He teleports into the church. Getman is yelling, "A devil that runs from flames, where are you? You can't hide forever." And Kurt teleports. "I've been waiting for so long to finally get you where I want you." He takes him outside. And David, tell us what happens. This is a big moment for Kurt in his journey as a hero.
Yeah, because he has the moment. He could kill him, right? I mean, he could just revenge. And at this very moment is where everything that Father Wagner instructed him comes up, and he decides to be a hero right at this very moment. He's not killing him. He's not killing the Getman villain of the story, right?
And it's quite violent for a minute. He teleports Getman. He drops him on the ground. He kicks him in the face. He throws him into a bunch of wood paneling, you know, throws him on the ground. He punches him again. He's got his foot on his throat. Like, he's quite violent here for a 13-year-old.
Yeah, and just see his face. I mean, Kurt Wagner face in this panel where he's just showing his fangs, and yeah, he looks like a demon, really. But at the next panel, he comes down, he is down, and he says, "Okay, I'm not going to do the same that you did to me."
Right. "This is what you always told me I was, and I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to be the person that you said I should be." He lets Getman go. And then here's the one that just doesn't work. I can try to make this fit into continuity however I like. So if Kurt is 13 here, he is not 13 in Giant Size X-Men number one. If Kurt is 13 here, I can see him going back to the circus. It's a different circus. He's with Margali. The next several years are like really happy. And then we have the Stefan story that results in Giant Size, right? Like, I can see that. That story works for me continuity wise, but nope, because here we have a completely different divergent story from Giant Size completely. Seth, do you want to tell us about this scene?
Oh, I just was thinking that Amanda would have a really hard time getting her job as a stewardess at the age of 8, 9 that she is in the story, you know? Maybe like 3 years past, she still shouldn't be working on an airplane. So at this point, yeah, Charles comes, shuts down everybody's brains as Charles does.
Charles calls him Kurt Shardosh here, which I don't know if I've ever seen that anywhere.
No, that's definitely a new one.
I haven't.
And then he wants to bring him home. It's a weird ending. It's almost feels like this is a story of like a game of telephone. Like if Jubilee was telling a new X-Men, like, this is what happened to Kurt. And like, you know, it's kind of like a little summary of everything, and she gets a lot of it kind of close. Like, you know, he was in a circus and Margali was there and he had two siblings and he got chased down in the village. It wasn't even villagers coming after him. It was just a small handful of people from the circus, it looks like.
Yeah.
I was expecting that Professor Xavier just wipe his mind and leave Kurt just to continue his life in another circus. I was expecting this end. But when I saw Professor Xavier appearing, I said to me, okay, maybe he's going to solve this situation and then just wipe Kurt's memory and then, you know, meet him in the future.
It's also possible that Xavier saved Kurt here and then Kurt went back to the circus and then years later Xavier came back. Like, that's possible, but that's a lot of continuity stacking. I don't know if I want to put those pieces together. But Xavier shows up. He's there. He's probably not physically there. It's probably a psychic projection. He says, "I'm a mutant just like you. I'm here to save you. I'm here to help you." And the dialogue here is really beautiful. As sad as the story is, it's really well written for the most part. Kurt says, "I bring pain upon anyone who shows me kindness. My mother, Armin, now Father Wagner, the only man who ever treated me like a human being. I must go back and help those I left behind." And Xavier says, "The priest will rebuild his church. Getman will find himself compelled to be kind to your family." So, like, it's a little mental coercion here. "The townspeople will think you died in the fire. I've seen to that. Your life here is over. Let me show you a new one. One where you can make a difference. A life of redemption, of compassion, with others who have similar gifts. Come and join my X-Men, Kurt Shardosh." "That man is gone," he says, "Herr Professor. He perished in the fire. My name is Kurt Wagner." So the only way this works is if Kurt goes back to the circus. And then years later, Giant Size X-Men number one happened.
Yeah,
but overwhelmingly, this is a beautiful issue. That final page of them walking with with the church burning in the distance is gorgeous. It's really beautiful.
It is. It is. And in that is a final page, you don't see Kurt accepting explicitly to join the X-Men, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the last sentence is, as you said, my name is Kurt Wagner. And then the end.
Now, the funny part, in the original printing of this book, it's followed up by a 3-page image of Kurt's first appearance from Giant Size. So it's basically them saying, hey, the story we just told you doesn't match.
And we know. And they recognize, right? Because otherwise, I wouldn't just put those 3 pages from the Giant Size X-Men. It doesn't
fit. Yeah. So the heart of it all, speaking as a kid who grew up in an abusive home, it took other people being kind to me before I found my worth. The queerness, the part of the journey that like didn't know how to love myself because I was caged metaphorically or closeted. There's some parts of me that really resonate with this. And this like idea of like, I'm going to love myself no matter who I am, queer or blue with yellow eyes, you know, like I'm going to love me and love my place in the world. And I'm going to hold myself to a higher moral standard than all those other shitty people. I like that part of this story a lot. And I think overwhelmingly, it's beautifully drawn and executed, even if it doesn't quite match. Seth and then David, I'd love to hear your final kind of thoughts or impressions on this issue before we wrap up.
Just super huge credit to Chris Sotomayor, because this is really carried by the sensitivity of the coloring. It's very emotive. It is gorgeous. It's atmospheric. There's like lovely candlelight, and it feels fairy tale like in his rendering. It's really beautiful. You know, the art is really good, but it is truly enhanced by color in this one.
Yeah, and I would add that after all, it's an X-Men story because it's not about superheroes flying. It's about a personal story being, you know, in an abusive environment, and you know, a story of coming of age. After all, so in that sense, I think it is really good in that sense, in that direction.
Yeah. I'm really happy we had this discussion. When I reread it last night, I'm like, I don't think I like this, but we're talking about it, and there's something special about it. There's some really cute moments in this, but it's not.
I feel like you find a way to like find worth in every story, which I appreciate about you, Chad. But like, I don't feel like there's any bad talent in the story. I just don't feel like editorial needed to make this story happen. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It really plays into Kurt as the orphan and the victim, which is part of him. Again, we talked about it, but it really plays. Seeing abuse on the page at this level is always deeply uncomfortable. I don't know. I'm really happy we had this conversation. It's wonderful to hang out with you both. And David, it's great to get to know you. I can't wait to hang out on the show again, if you are willing. I loved your book. I love your account. And it's just lovely to meet you in person. As we're wrapping up, let me have you share any final thoughts. Where can people find you online? And what would you like to plug regarding mid-April 2025?
You know, you can find me in classy.xmen in Instagram, especially. And my book, you know, is live in Amazon. You can find it in any Amazon store. So, Chad, it was a pleasure to be here. It was super fun to review this story and the backstory of Kurt Wagner, and also, you know, discuss with you and with Seth. Always a pleasure.
I'm so very sorry we didn't get to do that Beast Griffin story that you were dreading.
Yeah, maybe for the next time.
And then Seth.
Oh yeah, Chad has so many terrible stories. Don't worry. There's plenty to choose from. He seems to find them out of nowhere. So yeah, I would just like to say, buy Classic X-Men 1975. It is a wonderful book to flip through, to read a little at a time, to read in one sitting. It's a great gift. I see it is now out in hardcover in Portuguese. There is a lot of options for your friends. So if you are looking for a gift for an X-Men fan that they don't have yet, this is a really wonderful retrospective that I think anyone would be happy to have and digest and enjoy. And as far as me, you can see my art up on my own Instagram, SC Martel. You can see my work occasionally on Classic X-Men's Instagram or Gray Malkin Lane's Instagram. And I enjoy working with them both so much, and I'm super appreciative.
Make sure you're supporting, listeners, the people who do the things that you love, right? So if you see a book with a Classic X-Men title, you should definitely pick it up. Also follow Seth's work. Seth, you do incredible art, and people should be like hiring you for commissions and all kinds of things. You should be working professionally in comics, my friend. You're a delicious creator. You're number one and number two fan. You get to decide. Actually, Seth, I'm going to make you choose. Which one of us is your number one fan and which one of us is your number two fan?
Well, I got to go. I got up early. Sorry.
Oh, that's a difficult situation.
Lastly, I keep my own social media private because I got kiddos. David, you're welcome to follow me. Just ask. But you can follow the show, Gray Malkin_ Lane on Instagram. The next episode coming out on the main show immediately after this is the trial of Patsy Walker Hellcat. And it's going to be a hell of a good time. I love this character. She's so much fun. And I have a delicious jury assembled. Over on the Patreon channel, please watch for an episode all about Lyra, who is a little known undersea mutant. She's a villain of Namor the
Ooh, I say Lyra. You say Lyra, huh?
We talk about this on the show. Is it Lyra or Lyra? We have a whole thing.
Well, it's also like a double J, right? I mean, double L.
Double L, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, how would you say it then?
What's that?
How would David say it then?
Lyra. I would say Lyra in Spanish, but Lyra is not the same.
Yeah, we have a conversation about this on the show. Demanda comes in with Lyra, and the other two are Lyra. Lyra one time posed as the Invisible Woman so that she could have sex with Namor, and then she got pregnant with his nephew's child and had it implanted into her stomach, and then grown to the artificial age of 16, and then implanted her own mind into that child, and then sent it to rule Atlantis in Namor's stead. That's a real story. She also murdered his wife once, so yeah, it's crazy. She's a crazy character. We have a fun time. I just recorded that last night. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Seth and David, for hanging out with me this morning. We will see all of you back here next Monday on the Grey Malkin Lane Show. Thank you for listening to Grey Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Grey Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Grey Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Grey Malkin Lane.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Save big money on everyday items you need at Menards. Eliminate odors with damp-rid moisture absorbers. They're perfect for basements, attics, closets, and more. Damp-rid moisture absorbers work to attract and trap excess moisture to create noticeably cleaner, fresher air. Save big on damp-rid moisture absorbers at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.